From the Sky News Centre at 6, a teenager whose bomb threats caused more than 400 schools to be evacuated has been jailed for 3 years. George Duke Cohen sent emails warning of devices hidden in classrooms across the UK in March. He also sparked a security alert at a US airport after claiming a transatlantic flight was being hijacked. Mark Horsfalls from the National Crime Agency.
The actions of George Duke Cohen have caused widespread alarm and distress to pupils, some vulnerable teachers and parents alike, in what's been quite a lengthy campaign.
The Health Secretary says medicines will be given priority if there are delays crossing the English Channel due to a no-deal Brexit. The government says it could last 6 months but will ensure there aren't any medical shortages. Ted Baker's founder has been taken a leave of absence following harassment allegations against him. Ray Kelvin's being accused of giving unwanted hugs to staff, something the fashion company denies was insisted upon. Police in New Zealand say they'll continue reviewing CCTV throughout the weekend following the disappearance of a British backpacker. Grace Mullane was last seen in Auckland on Saturday. Travel safety expert Lloyd Figgins says this is unusual for the area.
The standards of safety, the standards of security, even in places like Queens Street, which is a backpackers' mecca in Auckland. On most of the bars, on most of the pubs there, they have security, and on the hostels themselves. So again, this feeds into that whole thing that this is a very rare event.
Virgin Atlantic pilots have announced a strike for the 3 days before Christmas. Members of the Professional Pilots Union have voted 7-1 in favour of a walkout over union recognition. And in sport, England's cricketers Ben Stokes and Alex Hales remain available for selection following a disciplinary hearing. The pair faced the Cricket Discipline Commission over charges of bringing the game into disrepute following an incident outside a Bristol nightclub last year. That's the latest. I'm Laura Safe.
Every Thursday afternoon for your weekly dose of the Caribbean.
Love Bristol. Love BCFM 93.2.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, it's 6 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Israeli-born saxophonist, author and thought criminal Gilad Atzmon. Also joined by Rayanne Wilson, who's back to action. It's one of the latest charities to be threatened with eviction by Bristol's Mayor Marvin Rees. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 7 o'clock news, US Secretary of State Mike Pompeo visits NATO in Brussels, where he explains US tactics of economic warfare and explains why China, Iran and Russia are in the Pentagon's sights. With all this talk of the Irish border, how neutral really is the Irish Republic? Edward Horgan is a former major in the Irish Army who's been exposing the use of Shannon Airport for rendition flights. Rendition may be over, but Edward believes Obama's drone assassination policy, now being carried out almost daily, is far worse. So is Ireland the second unsinkable aircraft carrier for the US Air Force? Plus the announcement of further charges against Israeli President Benjamin Netanyahu. Bribed a news site to get favourable coverage for him and his wife, allegedly. Also, Britain's state-sponsored child sex abuse scandal rumbles on, with many of the VIP paedophiles potentially in the clear, while, in a shocking turn of events, those who take allegations to the police could find themselves in jail. We hear from a former Metropolitan Police detective who's getting increasingly concerned that survivors of child sex abuse are being character assassinated by changes to the criminal justice system. Plus, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after seven. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 7 Celsius, wet and windy. This weekend, highs of 11, strong winds and light showers. Next week, again, around 11 Celsius, highs during the day. Sunny spells at the beginning of the week, but wetter and windier towards the end. Next weekend, the 15th and 16th of December, highs a little lower at around 9, sunshine and heavy showers next weekend. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news is Rayanne Wilson, whose Back to Action charity is the latest to be threatened with eviction by Bristol's Mayor Marvin Rees. I suppose, Rayanne, to be fair, it isn't actually necessarily Marvin himself who's threatened you, is it? You just get court papers from the legal services group, I imagine.
We got an email from one of the council, just council representatives, just to say that our lease wouldn't be renewed following 2 years of talks with them about renewing our lease.
Okay, well, just take us through what you do and also how you've helped restore that part of the Ashton Court estate.
So 3 years ago, an opportunity came up by which a close friend of mine had taken out a lease on that unit. Unfortunately, he kind of didn't meet his expectations and spoke to the council about a way out and kind of provided me saying, look, there's a guy who's got this company who is doing great things in Bristol and I think it would be better suited for him. The council then kind of almost assessed me. I had to provide documentation about me being a long-term partner and me wanting to move forward at that location because previously they had too many short-term kind of businesses pop up, close down, or whatever the case may be.
So they're looking for someone who can show that they can be there for 10 years or so.
Yes, a little bit of sustainability is what they were after. So then the initial steps were for me to take over the existing lease with the vision of me being a long-term partner. And it was always the case and always the kind of the language between me and the council was, we want a long-term partnership. You're exactly what we want on this site.
Okay, so what is Back to Action?
We originated in Easton here as a company in which helps individuals kind of meet their elite performance. We started off in a sporting background and we've now kind of branched out into several other domains, working with multiple charities across the UK, branching from London into Birmingham and into Bristol. And now we've kind of branched out looking at what's the best way for me to say it? Looking at how we empower staff members as well. Could we kind of looked at it and we thought, right, it's about training elite athletes and training athletes try and get to their peak. And then we kind of thought, hang on a minute, we get so many people, locals, and you know, we're in Ashton, so we're currently working with the Ashton community as well as the Eastern and St Paul's community, empowering these individuals not only to just search their dream in sport but trying to aspire in bigger careers in other areas of sport. So looking at physiotherapy, looking at sports science and looking at other things. Along the way, we've managed to put a number of people into uni who have now gone on, well, three have gone on to successful graduates, and we've got four currently on work experience and work placement with us.
So if I was to come and visit you,
yep.
What sort of thing would I see there? Exercise bikes, or is it more like a classroom?
No, so it's a, what we have, we call it our lab, to be fair. It's a modernised kind of gym space where we have some recent in the last 3 years they've been released gym equipment for kind of sports testing and human performance testing. We run a whole load of health checks from your kind of VO2 max right the way through to your kind of heart and lung function and capacity tests for, you know, we deal with a lot of local doctor surgeries as well. So we do a lot of health checks and health screenings. We've got a treatment room where we currently treat.
I think maybe Martin and I ought to pop down for a little check on that. Some of that, I'm not sure we would pass the test.
Yeah, we've got we offer a around the clock treatment service as well. So we've got a physiotherapist and a sports scientist who operate out of there, and a sports masseur who operate out of there. We've got a sports psychologist who he came from a psychology background. He's now gone and working with Bristol City, and he comes and consults from us as well to try and give back to. We work with a range of different kids who are falling out of school as well. So we're currently trying to work with that group from Bedminster and see if we can start empowering them through a different means of education.
Listen, Ryan, it sounds fantastic what you're doing, but you've put quite a lot of time and effort into restoring that place.
Yeah.
When did you do that?
Roughly two years ago.
The Ashton Court Mansion is pretty much derelict inside. I mean, it's not the sort of place that you want to work, but you actually have done some restoration work. When did
that
happen?
So I started that restoration work in 2016. And a large proportion of it was in the back end of the actual unit we got. There was severe damp. And it was a space which was just really kind of wasted. It was an old cafe prior to that, but the back end of the kind of unit was, when I say bricks and rubble, it was literally bricks and rubble. Whoever had left it before that had kind of moved out, and it was just left in a state. So we kind of took a year, 13, 14 months, to get the business up and running and up on its feet. And build some capital to be able to restore the building. And the vision was always, you know what, if we can restore this building into a beauty spot of this place, it'll be a fabulous place for people to come, want to learn, want to excel. And the whole thing was about providing an environment where you aspire to inspire.
Of course. But rather than patting you on the back, your landlords have served you with an eviction notice for, I believe, isn't it in a week's time or something?
Yeah, so it was served for in a week's time. And then we recently had news 7 days ago from Marvin that an extension will be placed up until the end of March 2019.
Well, that's another few months, but it's not a long time. And you've also had, I mean, who is actually dealing with this? Asher Craig or Marvin Rees? Because I know Asher said that, yes, you can have an extension for a certain period of time, mm-hmm. and then suddenly she changed her mind. So just explain what happened there.
From what I've been informed, Asher had come up to visit us. She then offered an extension, you know, yeah. We will be able to facilitate this, and then following an email, kind of her email correspondence to me thanking her for the actual extension, she was then informed that the work at the site was going to start end of December, early January, and then what was that? That was about 4 to 6 weeks ago, and then now, a week ago, Marvin's managed to come back and kind of put forward, look, the future isn't as, you know, is not. We know we have to move. However, he's managed to get it kind of consolidated that we can stay for the additional 120 days.
But I mean, the problem here is you've done this place up, and now you're being told out on your ear.
Yeah, that's the problem we're facing, because, like I said, we've been speaking to them for 2 years. So our whole thing was the council do not make decisions overnight. So we'd continually said, I'd continually said to the council representative when I put this money in, it was, if at any stage our lease is not going to be renewed, we need the adequate amount of notice for the sure investment that we put in. Now, when this eviction note email had come and I'd called the council representative, he'd actually apologised to me on the phone when I said, you know, could you shed some more light? And his words were, oh, Ray, I'm sorry. And it kind of baffled me a little bit, and I thought, what are you sorry for? And he kind of, his words to me were, because I know what you invested. Now, if that's not kicking the teeth, I mean, what is? Because it's clear that money now has gone down the drain.
Well, what's going to happen in your space, do you know? And what are they intending to do?
I've been told that they plan to put either the cafe there or build another cafe there. I'm not quite sure. I've spoken to several other council representatives who seem a bit baffled as to a cafe being moved there themselves. I've also been told that they wanted a business that complemented a cafe, which I was also informed that, yes, your business does complement the cafe. So it's, to be fair, I'm confused, let alone I know a few council representatives and members of the public who have offered their support along the way.
It just sounds to me like an abusive relationship where somebody has said to you, can you help us out? You've said, yes, I'll do that. And you've actually invested your time, effort and money into doing the place up. Now you're being told, go away.
Yeah.
Is there anywhere? Do you know anywhere? Because they did offer you, unbelievably. Is this true that they actually offered you a public toilet instead?
Yeah, they offered a public toilet that's opposite the Bristol City Stadium. And again, the words that were expressed in that email was the nature of, will ensure that this is a long-term lease because it's going to take a hefty investment. Yeah. So.
So how does it stand now, Ryan?
So currently we're still looking for a new home, because Ashton Court isn't going to be our long-term home as we thought, so we're still looking for a new home. We've kind of not found anywhere suitable, as you can imagine, the time's been quite short.
Now, I tell you what, if I was the council and I was your landlord, what I'd say to you is there is some more space actually up at Ashton Court Mansion, and you can have that rent-free because of what's happened, because you've actually done up the rest of it for us, which we're now intending to lease out to other people. Do you get any inkling that they're those sorts of landlords?
No, not at this precise moment in time. If anything, I get the inkling of, well, you decided to spend the money, so it's your fault. And I kind of turned around and said, you're right, I did spend the money, but I spent the money under these pretenses. I was told this. Now, had I have not been told it, I would not have spent the money. Or I might have spent a fraction of it to get me by to the next stage.
Okay, for anyone listening, thinking this, like I am, that this is an appalling thing for any council to do to, or any organisation actually, particularly a democratic one that we supposedly elect, to run out this city for our benefit as people, as the citizens. Is there anything people can do, Ryan?
Do you know, I've been thinking about this for long and hard. What could people do, and you know, how could anybody else in Bristol support anymore? I mean, if they are aware of anything, yes, I'd be grateful for any suggestions, whether they came to BCFM direct or whether they contacted me on my socials. My doors are always open. We work with people in Bristol, and we continue to want to work with people in Bristol. So if anyone's looking for a partnership, then yes, I'm open arms, and I just thank everyone for their support so far.
Okay, we better end it, I suppose, with just easiest ways for people to contact you. Maybe spell your name, that sort of thing,
yeah.
So people can find you.
So you can find me on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, on Rayon, R-A-Y-A-N, Wilson, W-I-O-S-O-N, or you can email me at Rayon, R-A-Y-A-N, Wilson, W-I-L-S-O-N, at BACK2, and then action.co.uk. Quite a long email, but yeah, I think you get the picture.
And I'll put those contact details up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Ryan Wilson, thanks very much
for joining us.
Martin Summers, this is a bit shameful, isn't it, that Marvin and the City Council, run by your party, the Labour Party, are doing this to somebody.
Well, it's the first I've heard of it, and I'm not happy about what I've heard. It seems to me this is bureaucratic beyond belief.
In a way, it's not the first, is it? Because we had the chap from the railway in a few weeks ago saying pretty much exactly the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think you've got to disentangle two things. There are policy decisions, and there are also the officers just grinding on doing what they do. The council is a kind of pretty weird beast. You know, there's a political side to it, and there's just a kind of bureaucratic
side. Well, this sounds like a business. Someone's trying to run a business where they're saying, we've got a part of our business, the cafe, that we want to expand, and anyone that's in the way has got to go.
Yeah, because the point is, what's happening because of the cuts is the commercialisation of the council's policies. I mean, they've even appointed somebody to do it, to be the commercialisation. And this is the big idea for dealing with the cuts, is we're going to turn it all into a business, a social enterprise. And don't forget, I used to work for the council.
Hang on,
in
Ray
the social
Ann
enterprise
is,
department.
Ann,
I was a social enterprise.
Ray-Ann is a social enterprise.
Well,
so
exactly.
Why are you booting him out?
Because the whole concept of social enterprise is a bit of a con, frankly, and I used to work in the field, so I know. Because what happens is, basically, you're ultimately talking about commercialisation of what should be public facilities. And then you put lipstick on the pig by pretending it's a community organisation thing that's not for profit. But in actual fact, you should just be providing this stuff anyway. Now, this is a particular case because obviously this kind of enterprise wouldn't have been set up by the council. It's obviously a grassroots thing which has been created outside of their control. And, you know, bureaucrats don't like that kind of thing.
Well, it's a Bristol organisation that has been helping people, senior people in the Premier League, footballers, these kinds of people. And it's the City Council saying, basically, sling your hook.
Well, I mean, I've heard of the decision, and don't forget, just because I'm a member of the Labour Party, I'm not responsible for all the council's decisions.
I just want you to explain what you think is going on in your
party. I think what's going on is commercialisation is definitely going on. The attack on the railway that they have up there.
I mean, didn't they call it privatisation? And isn't a sort of Blair policy?
No, what they're doing is the policy that's being adopted by the regime, if we can call it that, is we're going to get through this thing of having no money from central government by turning everything into a business. Now, actually, I don't think that's right. What Marvin should be saying to the core loyal Labour vote in the city is, I can't do very much to help you, and I'm not even going to pretend that I can. But what he's doing is he's taking over from where Ferguson, the previous mayor, with the whole idea that mayors are there to make a difference, delivering for Bristol. I got Marvin's email this morning, delivering for Bristol, and it's all rah, rah, rah. What we need to be hearing is the blood, sweat and tears speech. We can't actually do very much at all unless we change the national government. And kicking people out, you know, they're trying to rob Peter to pay Paul. And they might as well just be honest about it instead of pretending that there's some strategy, because I don't think there is.
What about we're also joined by Gilad Atzmon, who's a musician primarily, a thought criminal, an author, born in Israel. But you don't call yourself Jewish, Gilad. Why is that?
To start with, I was born in Israel, so I was primarily an Israeli. I've never been a follower of the Judaic religion, of Judaism.
People who are born in Israel, and if they're from a Jewish ethnic background, surely they are Jewish, aren't they?
Yeah, they could see themselves. My next project, my next book, will deal with exactly this question, because, as you may know, and I'm sure that some of your listeners know, Zionism, early Zionism, was in itself a very anti-Jewish project. The early Zionists were pretty upset when they look in the mirror. I'm talking about Herzl and Jabotinsky and Berl Katzenelson and all those kind of street names in Tel Aviv. They were really upset by the capitalist nature of the Jewish tribe, their removal from a peasantry connection to the soil, and they said, we are going to make the Jews people like all other people. So to a certain extent, Israel was an anti-Jewish project. I'll tell you something that people actually don't know. In 67, the military elite that regarded itself as Israeli used to look down at the government and to call them the Jews. So, for instance, Ezer Weizmann, who was the deputy of the chief of staff, would tell Yitzhak Rabin, who was the chief of staff, you're going to talk to the Jews. They were the Israelis, they looked down at the Jews. Anyway, so for me, not regarding myself as a Jew was, my peers, you know, at the time, wasn't a big issue. However, when I really immigrated to Britain, I started to play a lot around the world, I realized that I have very little connection with diaspora Jewry, and I decided that I want to be an ordinary human being. I demoted myself from being a chosen person into a very ordinary creature.
There is something I find a little bit disturbing about this whole thing of chosen people. It's a bit like a master race. Is that overstretched?
It's not. This is exactly what it is. Now, we have to be very careful, because when it comes to Judaism, in Judaism, you may be able to see the chosenness as a heavy burden. It is a commitment to special values and so on and so on. They have to carry work for the world. Whether they do it or not is a subject to a question. But when it comes to Jewish secular identity, they basically dropped God. They dropped this moral commitment that is attributed to them by God, and it has been reduced into racial supremacy. And as an anti-racist, I couldn't see myself any longer as a chosen person. I just couldn't allow it. And by the way, this is why I also argue that there is a serious contradiction between Jewishness and socialism. When people tell me we are Jewish socialists, I tell, how can you be a Jewish socialist? Socialism is universal. Jewishness is tribal, and it adheres to chosenness. There is a problem there.
What about the Labour Party? Because they've kicked a lot of people out, haven't they, over this whole business? The Conservatives, or virtually none.
As far as I know, none at all. I'm absolutely...
And yet, let me tell you, my experience over the years is the only anti-Semitism I've come across was within a particularly right-wing Conservative local constituency party. Never. I've never come across it within the Labour at all. Seems to be something very strange going on there. What do you...
It is not that strange. The tyrannical manner in which the Labour Party performs is really depressing to watch, but it shouldn't take us by a complete surprise. As people know, I have a lot of respect to Jeremy Corbyn. I think that for many years he supported Palestine. At times I was really disappointed with him because he didn't stand for what I believed to be, you know, the right cause. You know, he wasn't firm enough, maybe. But at the end of the day, he survived, which is quite an achievement. However, the party around him, as far as I can tell, is a total disaster. And I can tell you in the most firm manner that I don't think that I like to live in a country that is ruled by people who expel members of their party because they disagree with them on some issues. I cannot see this party as ready to lead the country, and you were very right. I've never seen the Conservative Party or its bodies interfering with any form of freedom of speech. It is always the Labour, and it is very, very depressing. Now, in my work, I'm not a political commentator. I'm a philosopher. In my work, I actually explain what is happening here. The difference between left and right should be very clear to all of us by now. Left is set as a dream. It is there to tell us what the world ought to be. We are supposed to live in equality. We're supposed to respect each other. It's a great dream. It's a great idea. I believe in it. The right is committed to reality. Therefore, the debate between the left and the right should be set as, the left will say we are supposed to live in equality, and the right answer would be, can't you see that people aren't equal? What I'm saying here is the left is shaped like a dream, and by the way, it's not an original idea. Slavoj Žižek wrote quite a lot about it. The left is shaped like a dream. The right is shaped like an insomnia. The problem that is entangled with the idea that the left is shaped like a dream is that it is becoming more and more delusional, more and more detached from reality. And when someone in the left comes with kind of an insight or point at reality, they are rejected immediately because this is what we may see as a wake-up call. You don't like to be awakened in the middle of the night. This is why the left is developing animosity towards truth tellers. Now, it is not that something is wrong about class politics. It is not that something is wrong about equality. Equality is right. Class politics could be right if you still have working class. Now we have workless class, as we all know. The problem with the left has something to do with the metaphysical structure. And this is something that until now we have kind of 150 or 170 years of working class politics. No one has managed to resolve it. And this is why the revolution has never happened.
Okay. Martin, Gilad is pointing the finger very, very squarely at the Labour Party as a completely failing.
It's more than the Labour
failing,
Party.
Failing. Well, yeah, but yeah. I mean, particularly the Labour Party. Yeah.
Example,
I mean, for example, we have Ken Livingstone, who is a potential leader of the Labour Party, who has been completely shut out by this whole process.
For telling the truth.
Martin.
Well, if you pick up the point of Livingstone, Livingstone has resigned from the Labour Party because he said, I don't want to be the issue. He's actually been very, as in everything else he's done, he's been pretty canny. And, of course, he talked about the relations between the Nazis and the Zionists during the 1930s, which, of course, is historical fact. Nobody can deny it.
It was said that he said that Hitler was a Zionist. Actually,
no,
what he really said
no, he didn't
was
say that.
What he really said was that Hitler supported Zionism.
Well, we know there was actually I've got a History Today article from the 1960s about how an SS colonel went with a leading Zionist to Israel, or what was not then Israel, in order to scope out. So one of the things they were thinking about,
Martin,
maybe we could just get all the Jews to go.
The question,
here.
Martin, is why can't the Labour Party stomach historical fact?
Well, it's the Labour Party and the left in general is actually a wide, you know, it's a huge variety of different people with different strengths. I take your point about the left having a vision, a dream, and the right being realists. Yeah. But on the other hand, you have pragmatic leftists, for example, the Swedish Social Democrats, who achieved a great deal in Sweden, although it's now being undermined. You also have right-wingers who have delusional dreams, like the neoliberal dream of the free market economy, which was imposed in Eastern Europe when I used to work there in the 90s, with swivel-eyed determination, even though it had nothing to do with the problems the societies were facing.
From the 90s, we are starting to talk about post-political universe. We didn't realize it then, but we definitely realize it now. And the difference between left and right are definitely not metaphysical, and in general, they are marginal. So, you know, this is why one of the most horrifying things for me was to find out that new left identitarian politics actually adopted the most embarrassing and problematic aspect of Hitlerian politics. And what do I mean by that? What did they do, the identitarian leftists? They divided us into segments. They taught us to speak as a woman, as a Jew, as a black, as a Muslim. Most of those identities are biologically oriented.
But
let me just finish. Who was the politician who taught us to think in terms of biology, to identify with our biology? Hitler. This is what the left is doing now.
If you're going to identify and do something about inequalities in society, you have to look at people in separate units. Some are simply, you know, gypsies, for example. You can't pretend you're not a gypsy, because actually you need to look at gypsies being marginalised and ostracised. So
I think
you're not actually dividing society. What you're saying is the divide is already there.
No, I actually don't agree. And I think that for us, I think that we're all the same age, more or less. We grew up in a world where the left message, and it was a very appealing message, and I subscribe to this message. The message was, it doesn't matter if you are a gypsy, as you say, or if you are a Jew, if you are a Palestinian, we are all together against the bad guys, i.e. the city, the capital, the money. We were together. In a way, and some leftists, old leftists, like my thought because they think that I bring back class politics. In fact, I don't bring back class politics because we cannot think anymore in terms of class. I actually turn it into something wider. Well, we are all human beings, and we have to find what is that unite us as human beings, as opposed to what divides us as identitarians.
Let's just bring this down to personalise it a bit, Gilad, because okay. You've just been through earlier this year a quite horrible court case, haven't you? If you could just explain what happened there.
Yeah, this court case, it never matured into a court case. I wrote an article on my website. The title of the article was Anti-Semitism is Merely a Business Plan. And I explored the idea that a lot of the statistics that we see in the case of anti-Semitism is problematic, so to say, and these issues have now been explored widely. I was sued by a chairman of the campaign against anti-Semitism, Gideon Falter. And as it happened, we didn't agree about the meaning. There was a hearing, to determine the meaning. And as it happened, the judge Nicklin, decided that the meaning that attributed to my article, amongst many things, he argued that I accused the CIA and Falter of fabrication, while we believe that it was dishonesty. I argue immediately that there is no way I'm going to defend fabrication. I don't think that these bodies are... Sorry. I made a mistake here. The judge came to a conclusion that that I accused them of fraudulent behavior. Now, fraudulent behavior means a criminal intent. I don't believe that the CIA definitely motivated criminally, but the CIA are motivated by criminal intent. They are motivated ideologically. So my option was to appeal, but every act in the High Court in Britain cost around 20 to 30 to 40 thousand quid, and I couldn't afford it, and I was pushed into settlement, and this left me with very substantial bills. And as it happened, and I didn't know how strong is the support for my work, people from all over the world, many of them from England, many of them from Israel, and Jews, in fact the biggest 10 or 7 donations came from Israeli and Jews, stood up for me and actually took care of all the bills until now, which is amazing. We are talking about more than 100,000 quid of bills. A large part of it is paid now. So the lesson for me was that England is not any more a place, an environment, a realm for authors, for musicians, for thinkers. It is becoming a tyrannical society. Funny enough,
if all those authors, thinkers, musicians, writers disappear, then they will have won. The tyrannical people will have won.
I think that they've won already. And I think that the guy, it is very interesting, you know, because George Orwell wrote 1984 about Britain. In America and Britain, this book was studied as a kind of critical attempt to deal with a Soviet-like state. No, it was written about Britain, and it was written about a state that is controlled by what I think is so as the future of the Labour Party. It is a book about the British Labour Party. It
Martin,
is quite
Martin, do you want to respond to that idea of Orwell writing this about Labour?
He said Ingsoc in 1984 is not to be seen as the current Labour Party, of which I am a supporter. It was an anti-Soviet book, and it was pushed very strongly, for example, by MI5, MI6, and Orwell actually was involved in fingering various of his colleagues as communists during that era.
But do you think that maybe it's come back to bite them on the bottom now?
Well, I think it's a work of art, which is going to be, it's still read in schools. It's going to be read into the future because it's about a Soviet-style state, but it's also about totalitarianism in a general way.
I don't think that he described. I deal with this question. I don't think that he described the Labour Party in 1948. It is describing the future of the Labour Party based on the experience that Orwell went through in 1936 in Spain.
Yes, that's right.
Let's pin this down to some stuff that's been going on this week. And I found it fascinating that the Shadow Chancellor, John McDonnell, was talking about the Brexit plans in terms of, maybe we should just have a second referendum, this sort of thing. Let's have a listen to what he had to say in the House of Commons this week on the beginning of the beginning of the Brexit debate bill.
This week's report from the Joseph Rowntree Foundation should be a wake-up call to all of us. The report confirmed 1.5 million people living not just in poverty, in destitution, including 365,000 children. If we're to learn anything from the referendum vote, is that so many of our people want change. And the decision on Brexit is fundamentally a choice about the kind of country we want to live in.
Well, that's an interesting sort of way to phrase it. He's saying, if we're to learn anything from the referendum vote, the people want change, Gilad. And really, to John McDonnell, that means a general election. It doesn't mean, say, some kind of Brexit.
By the way, people want change in many places. Britain is not alone. First, we saw it in Scotland. Half of the Scots wanted to split. Then we saw it in Brexit. Then we saw it in America. Now we see it in France. We see it in Greece. We see it all over the world. There is a serious fatigue of the global economy. There is a serious fatigue of identitarian politics. There is a very serious appeal to populist thinking, or to populism, should I say. The big question now, and actually Steve Bannon, who probably you two don't approve him, I'm not his follower, Steve Bannon actually spoke about it recently in a debate, and he said the only question, we are going towards populism, the only question whether it is a left populism, socialist populism, or capitalist populism a la Trump. Now,
hang on, because populism can mean all sorts of different things to lots of different people. It seems to be, something which is a reaction against neoliberalism to me. But anyway, let's have a listen to Ken Clark. He says something also very interesting this week. He's the only person in the whole of the Conservative Party that voted against triggering Article 50. He's also a former member of the steering committee of the Bilderberg conferences, who were very instrumental in bringing about the European Monetary Union and the European Union itself, and steering things through Maastricht, that kind of thing. And this is what he had to say about the referendum. He considers that it was just an opinion poll.
Order! Order!
The ayes to the right, 498. The noes to the left, 114.
MPs have voted overwhelmingly in favour of beginning the process of leaving the European Union. Legislation.
Ken Clark was the only Tory rebel.
Well, I was probably the only Conservative who'd been quite so forthright about sticking to my views and my view, what the national interest demanded, and not just giving in to an opinion poll and starting to vote for things I didn't actually believe in.
I don't know how to...
I mean, the opinion poll said we weren't going to vote for Brexit, didn't it? But this, apparently, the referendum was an opinion poll, according to Ken.
The fact that we are drifting away from law, from a commitment to our political statements, to our political agenda, to our ideological belief, none of that should take us by surprise. I think that we see it all over. If there is a poll, it doesn't we are supposed to be committed to. It doesn't work for some people who have enough money to mount pressure on the government. We'll see a lot of chaos. What is so amazing for me when I'm looking at, I try to follow what is happening with Brexit. It is very clear to me that there is a huge fuss, huge debate, and no one, including the politicians who are voting on it, including the BBC specialist who's supposed to understand what is going on and to deliver the information to us, no one understands what the debate is all about.
Isn't this deliberate? Don't you think this
I'm sure that it's deliberate.
The idea is, oh, it's all far too confusing, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, I would like to do something to redress that balance because by asking both of you, as we did, same as we did last week, what you think is most likely to happen, is it likely to be no deal, Theresa May's deal? Do you think the Prime Minister could disappear next week? Could there be another election within the Conservative Party for a new leader? Or no Brexit? Gilad.
This is very interesting that you are asking because I'll surprise you. I'm not a political person, and even if I were, I wouldn't allow myself to comment on these political issues
Martin.
Because I'm an immigrant.
Okay, Martin.
Well, the way it's playing out is there is definitely Theresa May's deal is dead in the water. That's quite clear. That's not going to happen.
It does seem this is a deliberate car crash that's been set up here to happen next week, isn't it?
No, it's not a deliberate car crash. It's just politics, Tony. Well, she hasn't got the votes.
Why would she try and get everyone behind a deal that she knows she can't win on?
Because she's a rather stubborn individual of a rather mediocre talent.
But she's lost touch with reality if she thinks she can get it through, doesn't she?
Well, that's right. But what will happen is reality will feed back and she won't get it through.
You think she'll go next week?
Well, what will then happen is that the Tories won't want to replace her because what the Labour Party are then going to do, under the previous constitutional position, before the Fixed Term Parliament Act, her loss of that vote would trigger a general election. That's what would have happened before the Tories and the Lib Dems came up with this ridiculous Fixed Term Parliament Act. But under the new rules that the Tories rammed through in that period, you've then got to have, you don't get a general election automatically. And because if the DUP don't switch sides, and of course there's a possibility the DUP may switch sides and vote in a vote of confidence against Theresa May to bring her down and have a general election. So the first choice of the Labour opposition is to force a general election.
Well, we know, but that's very unlikely. What do you think is going to happen?
So then they're going to try and force that. It really depends which way the DUP jump. Because if the DUP supports a confidence motion, she's out.
Don't forget,
Tony.
Martin, I can't see the DUP voting with the Labour Party.
Well, they might. Because on social issues, in fact, they're quite left. You know, they're not. So it's a possibility. Anyway, the other thing is, I'd just like to mention at that point, if Sinn Féin turned up, of course they don't do because of their own constitution. If they did, she'd be already out, and we wouldn't be talking about any of this. That's the constitution of Britain. Now, what will then happen is Dominic Grieve's thing that's gone through is there won't be a No Deal Brexit because there's no majority for that in Parliament. So at that point, what's probably going to happen is we're going to stop the clock and carry on negotiating. negotiating. And the EU have already said, if you want to stop the clock and carry on negotiating, we're happy with that. So that's what will happen.
With Theresa May in charge
If Theresa May will stay in charge, because the Tories won't get rid of her, because if they try and get rid of her, that triggers a general election. And then, of course...
Surely they can have a... Yeah, but there may be more people, enough Conservative MPs, to decide that Theresa May's... big humiliation next week...
She may go, and then there will be a Tory internal election, which will inevitably go to a hard Brexiteer. Now, at that point, the left wing of the Tory party, the Dominic Grieve people, won't support that person... And then the general election will be triggered. Okay?
So Dominic Grieve is not going to trigger a general election. He's going to stomach a leader that he doesn't necessarily in the Conservative Party. Martin, let me finish this sentence. He's going to stomach a leader he doesn't necessarily want in the Conservative Party rather than trigger a general election, isn't he?
Not necessarily. Now, what's beginning to happen, I do follow this quite closely, is there are discussions going on behind the scenes about triggering a second referendum. If we can't get a general... We should have a general election under the... under the previous rules, under all the rules that have been running for hundreds of years, there should be a general election,
but you're not going to get
it. There won't be a
general... Let's just be realistic, Theresa, can we just be realistic about this, rather than sort of crying over spilled
milk? Well, I'll tell you what's going to happen, Tony. There's going to be a second referendum. That's what's going to happen.
Okay, so that's what you think.
I think that's
And you think there's going to be no Brexit in the meantime?
And if there's a second referendum, Tony, I know you voted for Brexit, you might not have it at all.
Well, what's
Don't
the,
cry for
what's
your mum, will
point
you?
Is that?
Look, I'm just pointing
I'm
out.
I'm not crying for my mummy. I'm trying to ask, you know, what you're asking me to happen.
You're asking me as an analyst rather than as a political activist what will happen, and I'm trying to put the analysts together.
What's quite likely to happen then, if there is a second referendum, is that this is not what the people want, and that it may be just simply the same result.
All right,
if
it's the same result, it'll be resolved, but it won't necessarily be the same result, because as this crisis develops, there's going to be a run on the...
There's going to be a third referendum.
Well, don't forget, they had lots of referendums in Northern Ireland to resolve this sovereignty issue.
Yeah.
And it's at the heart of this. They're talking about civil war before we
I'll tell you what
on.
We'll do. We'll have a listen to Matt Fry on... we'll have a listen to Matt Fry on... well, no, of course not. And that's what the people voted for, but you don't seem to be interested. Matt Fry on Channel 4 News last night had a very interesting conversation with his guests, and those guests were talking about whether they thought there was likely to be a second referendum.
Second referendum as one way of dealing with this Gordian knot, Gerard?
I think I'm with Martin on that, in the sense that it would cause a democratic issue.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's ways and resolutions in Parliament and the process to provide the answer.
OK, let's go back to the audience. Who would like a second referendum? Hands up. One person? Are you serious? OK. All right, that's very interesting. And I can't ask you because you're too far away from the microphones, but I guess you don't want a second referendum, because the first referendum, as far as you're concerned, that was the people's vote. OK.
So what do you make of that, Gilad? What he's saying there on Channel 4 News last night was that out of a crowd of about 25 people, only one of them is interested in a second referendum. But it looks like that's one of the things that we might be served up by the political class. And you say even a third one.
Yeah, I think that we'll have a third one and a fourth one, and unless we find kind of a solution that Soros is really happy with, and assuming that he will live long enough, because he's quite old already.
Let's have a listen to... one of the things I'd like to try and do is to give a little bit more clarity to some of the rather muddy stuff that we get from the BBC. And I was quite impressed with two of the alternative potential deals. One of them is the Norway deal, the other is the Canada Plus deal. David Davis, in the debate in the last couple of days in the House of Commons, spelled out exactly what these two things mean.
Norway Plus appear to have three actual virtues to it, as their protagonists say. First was it's the easiest negotiation, they thought, the simplest. It's the smallest movement, and therefore the simplest negotiation. Secondly, it meets the conditions of the referendum, they say. And thirdly, it's the softest of soft Brexits. All possibly good arguments, except they're not true. The negotiation, it's not simple. We can't simply just stay in the EA. That doesn't work. Jean-Claude Pyrrhus, the ex-head of the EU legal service, said in terms we'll have to renegotiate every single clause of EEA arrangement. It will require unanimity from 30 different members. And they are going to exact a price. Now, one of the advantages of Norway, you would think, is we control our own fisheries policy. But are we going to get that? with a vote from Denmark and a vote from France and a vote from Spain? No, we're not. That's one of the problems in this. The negotiation hurdles are very big. It's cited that Michel Barnier said this was a possible outcome only in conjunction with customs union membership. The two together, we are locked. We are basically in a worse position than the government's proposal. We're basically locked into the single market. No say, no control, but in every other respect, including free movement of peoples and paying money, we'll be locked there. Norway does not find it satisfactory. Politically, frankly, a country like ours certainly should not. So that doesn't work. Finally, it delivers on the result of the referendum. No, it doesn't. Free movement, money, independent trade policy, jurisdiction, supranational courts, rule taker, on all of those, we fail under Norway. So what's left? The last thing that's left is the free trade agreement. Now, I have long thought this was the best option. This is the one that's been called Canada Plus Plus Plus. It's been called Super Canada and a variety of other names. And somewhere buried in the middle of DEXU, in the middle of my old department, there is a piece of paper, well, actually, watch that thick, laying out how this can be done in detail, including some legal text. The concept is simple, and that's important in this context because we're going to have a very limited time in the last few months to negotiate this. And this is the point I made when a couple of years ago when I was making this argument. This is the 3 months that matter. The European Union always takes the negotiation down to the wire. Always. The last hour, the last day, the last hour, the last minute, the last second. Sometimes it stops the clock to allow the negotiations to conclude. And that's what's going to happen here, I suspect. I suspect we're going to go right into deep into time on this. So why was this attractive? It was attractive because we could build it from precedents. Canada is an EU-negotiated precedent. And you could add to it, the plus, plus, plus means all the bits that are not good about Canada. There's no decent mutual recognition agreement. You can lift that out of South Korea, or the Australian deal. There's no decent phytosanitary arrangements. You can lift that out of New Zealand. So you go back to them and you say, here we have a proposal constructed entirely of your own precedents. It can't undermine the single market because you negotiated it. It can't undermine the four principles because you negotiated it. So that's the attraction of the Canada Plus Plus Plus. That's why it's based on that template. All based on precedents previously negotiated by the Commission. So it is perfectly possible for us to create a draft legal text on the basis of where we are now and put that back to the Union and say the $39 billion rides on this. You have to agree the substantive elements before we sign off, and then you have to agree the detail elements by the end of 2019. Plenty of time to do that on the basis of an existing boilerplate text. That's what we should be doing. We should stop grovelling to Europe and start grasping our future. Yeah, yeah.
So there's former Brexit Secretary David Davis, really, I suppose, taking a fairly hard line, Gilad, over this. Mervyn King, though, we had a clip from him last week on this show. He's now, this week, in a opinion piece in the Bloomberg magazine. He's saying the Brexit deal is like Nazi appeasement. A lot of people talking about Nazis these days, it seems. He says the deal should be abandoned. He said that Mark Carney has warned food prices could rise between 5 and 10% if there was a disorderly Brexit. Theresa May faces deep opposition in Parliament. Lord King wrote, there have been three episodes in modern history when the British political class let down the rest of the country. In the 1930s with appeasement, in the 70s when the British economy was the sick man of Europe and the government saw its role as a managing decline.
I think that we are dealing with this topic in an anecdotal manner, and we are really missing the point. It's not about first referendum or second referendum or what kind of deal. First question we have to ask ourselves, what is it that made 52% of the Brits want to split? And these are okay. The issues that must be addressed.
Answer your own question in 10 seconds.
Okay, I think that it was manufacturing, they want work, they want authentic identity, and they don't want immigration.
Okay, time for the Murdoch News at 7. Thanks to our guest, Israeli-born saxophonist you just heard there, an author, Gilad Atzmon, and we'll be back with him and Martin Summers after the news.
Online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.